Welcome to Pushback, a social justice podcast produced and distributed by Philadelphia Magazine and Word Radio. What's up, ladies and gentlemen? This is Flood the Drummer.
Malcolm Burnley.
And this episode is about black intellectuals. So, Malcolm, there's like a roster of black intellectuals that I could choose from that I want to interview, but I already have one in mind. Who's your favorite and who would you want to interview and why?
I mean, I feel like this is kind of a basic and obvious answer, but I'm going to say Malcolm X.
Oh, why? That's not basic for me. I mean, I wouldn't assume
Well, I don't know. My name is Malcolm, and like, it's the first thing that pops into mind. My dad often said that I was in part named after Malcolm X.
Oh, really?
So from a really early age, I remember trying to read the autobiography. Well, I did read it, but like didn't really comprehend it, and then read it multiple times over my life. I've always been really interested in his evolution over time, and also I've always been really interested in, especially now, kind of his legacy and how many different groups latch onto it. Like, there's all these socialist groups that affiliate with Malcolm X in kind of the later part of his life. Obviously, black nationalist groups. I just find kind of the diversity of intellect that he kind of embodied. And what about you? What about which intellectual would you interview?
I think it would have to be James Baldwin. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if I'm looking at it from a long-term perspective. No, actually, you know what? I'll take that back. But I really do want to interview James Baldwin. I would have loved to. But I think I want to interview, it would be W.E.B. Du Bois.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because for those who may not know, he was the first sociologist to do the study he did, which resulted in the Philadelphia Negro.
Right.
And that was commissioned by the University of Pennsylvania. It was a huge deal. He did it at 7th and South, when that was a largely black neighborhood before it was gentrified. Mm. And he wrote a really long book, a really profound piece of literature that's still relevant today, about how black people weren't as united as he thought, how they still were divided among class lines, how he felt like an outsider even among his own people. And I just would have liked to kind of depose him, if you will, of how his expectations were met and how he faced disappointment and how he dealt with the disappointment.
I think his writing is also really interesting in that, like, I think he felt, or at least I've always interpreted this in his writing, maybe not ostracized, but felt separated as a black intellectual. I think that there was an element to some of his story and some of his writing of maybe not loneliness is the right word, but I think he struggled with that at times, right? I mean,
I would assume any black intellectual struggles with some sort of isolation. I think to be a quote unquote intellectual requires a lot of thinking. A lot of thinking requires a lot of solitude, right? You can't really think if you're amongst people. Yeah, sure, there's think tanks, but those type of intellectuals were putting out pieces and op-eds and long-form material. And so I would imagine that they intentionally spent a lot of time alone, as probably do intellectuals do today. I know I do. I intentionally separate myself. I take time to unplug and read and just relax. And so I think that's actually pretty normal. But I think what's interesting about the quote-unquote black intellectuals is that with even in that niche, there's division, right? Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois were two black intellectuals of their time, and they saw opposite ways for blacks to advance. So it's interesting when you look at the pool of black intellectuals from ranging from a Malcolm X to a W.E.B. Du Bois. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure we'll probably get into this in this episode. And I don't know if you feel this way, but it feels like when we talk about black intellectuals, it is a very male-dominated sport, right? Do you see that to be the case?
Yeah, at least when you say the term black intellectuals, like, whether that's unfortunate or whether that's my fault, like, most of the people that come to mind are men. And I guess that's partially because also, I first think about, kind of the 1950s, 1960s era black intellectuals. Those are the first that come to mind. And it seems like that's always the connotation, and I think that's really unfortunate. And even if you kind of take it up to modern day, a lot of the black intellectuals that you see on television and the most prominent ones you see in print, it's not true that it's exclusively, but I feel like most of the people getting speaking engagements are men.
Mm-hmm.
At least most of the ones that you think of. I mean, obviously there's like Michelle Alexander, like, mm-hmm. It's not as if the kind of most famous ones today aren't exclusively men. But I think that's an issue.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that there needs to be there has to be a balance in the way that we look at intellectualism and genius, because in one way we tend not to celebrate it too much because we don't want people feel embarrassed when they celebrate it. We don't want to be overly pretentious for some reason. But then at the same time, we don't realize what we're doing to the younger generation who themselves may be mentally gifted or who may be black intellectuals, and they don't feel the urgency to embrace it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, imagine the young black kid in school who really wants to put his hand up first, who knows all the answers, but he knows he's going to get picked on. He knows that being a black intellectual, right, or being a black smart kid isn't probably the best thing to do because nobody in his community is embracing it. So I think there has to be a balance in the way that we do that, because it's always about representation, mm-hmm, right? And we have to represent. If you're a black intellectual, you shy away from the term, but don't shy away from the practice.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So should we, I guess, bring in the guests at this point?
Yeah, because I think we've hyped it up, and I think I want to see how they define this term. And I'm excited about this conversation. Who we have slated first up is a intergenerational conversation with three black men. Gregory Walker, who's in his 50s. He's the creative director of the Brothers Network. They engage black men in high arts and culture, and they use media to change the narrative around black men and to show them as intellectuals. We have Shamar Beasley, recently 21, I believe, a student leader at Drexel University, and Carlo Campbell, who goes by the name Afflo when he's on stage. He actually just translated his transcripts of music into a book for literature lovers. And that could be found on lulu.com. So that's going to be the first conversation.
He does also does some theater as well.
He's a brilliant actor. I don't know how I could not even mention that. I've seen him on stage several times. And speaking of Malcolm X, he's done some work around that and some programs in Malcolm X Park. But he's actually a really good actor. And I've had the opportunity to play behind him as a drummer when he's on stage rapping. And then after that, we'll have our ladies panel with Dr. Naisha Jr., the religion department at Temple University. She'll be joined with Andrea Lawful Sanders, an entrepreneur, writer, and nonprofit leader. And then last but not least, of course.
Yeah, we're going to have Ernest Owens, who is a award-winning journalist in Philadelphia for G Philly, also on BET, syndicated columnist, and he is never short of opinions. So we'll bring on Ernest to also discuss some topics in black intellectualism.
So, guys, thanks for being here. We want to start, I guess, with current events and talking about President Obama leaving the White House. And one of the things Malcolm and I have been talking about was, President Obama wasn't just the first black president. He was also a black intellectual, one of the first black intellectuals, the first black intellectual. And I'd like to hear from you, Greg, and then follow up with Shamar and then Carlo on what was your expectations after Obama? Were you hoping to see more black intellectuals run for office? Were you hoping to see more black intellectuals follow him? And if not, why?
One of the things that I struggle with is this term black intellectual. I understand what it means aesthetically, but I also wouldn't want people to think they would not have an opportunity. Here in democracy, anybody and everybody is eligible to run for public office. It doesn't have to be an intellectual. You don't have to be black. You don't have to be a man. But anybody and everybody is eligible. That's what democracy is. What I am most struck by is that my first encounter with Mr. Obama, and that was in the 1990s when he was on law review at Harvard University. So it was from that moment forward that I thought he was going to be the lightning rod that would lead this country into more elected officials of all races and genders and ethnicities. I think that what I'm surprised about is that people think you have to be a black intellectual to run for public office. The fact of the matter is you have to care about your community, you have to care about your town, you have to care about issues, and then you can run for public office, whether it's the dog catcher, a judge, whether it's the president of the United States, state senate, whatever it is, as long as you care about your community, your constituents, not necessarily your people, but your constituents, because that changes. I can go on, but I'll stop there.
But so are you separating this idea of people who are intellect and black from the layman?
I think that we get a little confused in democracy, and democracy in the Constitution was built so that anybody and everybody is eligible as long as you are a citizen, and maybe one day that will even change as well. everybody is who is eligible to vote, and everybody is eligible to hold office.
Did you expect to see other black intellectuals follow suit, and if not, why? Well, I understand that we don't know yet, though.
I expected for the, and I think ironically, now that Donald Trump is the president, we're going to see an uptick in the number of people running for public office, intellectuals and otherwise, but people who care about this country, care about their city, care about their town. Yeah. So I definitely think that. So I want to unfold and unbend this idea of black intellectuals running for public office, because quite frankly, in cities all across America, many of the people who hold public offices and make decisions are not intellectuals. Mm-hmm. And that starts right now with our current president.
Oh, go ahead, Shamar.
What I was going to say was, I don't necessarily believe that the question was, you know, framed in that manner. Now, I mean, you did make a very valid point there, but in regards to Barack Obama inspiring an entire, well, I would say my entire generation, I'm sure he inspired many other generations as well. He absolutely did do that. He was a black intellect. He was one of the first people to actually take the position as president, you know, as like an intellect in that capacity, and still come off as cool and suave mm-hmm. and everything else. He was relatable. He, you know, definitely was amicable. Like, everyone loved President Obama while he was in office. I mean, towards the end part of there, you know, it didn't really hold up, but.
Go ahead, Carla. You going to say?
I was thinking a lot about back in the day, they used to have these requirements for black people to vote.
Mm-hmm. That's
and
right.
used to have black to pass a test.
That's right.
With the uptick of anti-intellectual sentiment in the highest of offices, namely the president's office, I believe that going forward, they should make some sort of take some initiative, maybe, you know, some sort of law that maybe you should have to pass a constitutional test before you're even able to
IQ test.
This man, no, not IQ test. That came from the Nazis. But
that's right.
It did.
We're about to go back there now, but, so why not?
Yeah. But that would be able to weed out those sorts of things, because we are dealing with a guy who clearly has no knowledge of the executive, judicial, legislative branch, checks and balance. He has no concept of this. And we're living in a world where the anti-intellectuals are fed by his anti-intellectualism. So I would like to see somebody, I would like to see anybody with a modicum of intellect run for office. When speaking in regard to the black thing and being motivated by Obama, I believe he's a cool dude. I believe he's dope. I don't believe he's black per se. Mm-hmm. I believe he's African and American. Mm-hmm. I believe it's different. Like, when I embrace the idea of being black, I don't embrace it from a color. I embrace it in the idea of my eyes are closed. I can't see. Who am I? Like, we can't see. We can't see who we are. We don't have a point of reference to where we come from. So when I embrace the idea of being black, my history has been blacked out.
So you don't embrace the term black intellectual?
I do, from the idea of mutuality of historical continuum.
So,
you know, his historical continuum is not the same as
right.
ours. Kenya, I would love to be able to say I came from Kenya. I would love to be able to say my mom came from Kansas, you know, and know all of my stuff.
Right.
And so that has an intense and immense effect on his ability to have that confidence and to do his thing, too, in a way that another so-called black man, that say if this brother did become the president, his hurdle would be different. What he would go through to get to there, you know, based on what his experience has given him, would be a different thing. And I do hope, you know, that intellectualism does not cancel out the human element of things.
So this was a great conversation. I just want to ask one thing beyond politics, even though that was a great conversation about politics. The question I had was, you know, we started framing the conversation around Obama, but at the same time, outside of the political realm, I feel like there's kind of been an explosion of maybe not black intellectualism, if you want to call it that, but dialogue about black issues over the last few years, you know. Yeah. And Ta-Nehisi Coates is probably, you know, arguably the most famous author in the country, and he wasn't nearly that case when Obama was first elected. So I guess I was just wondering, so moving outside of politics, have you perceived that? Do you feel like there has been an explosion of black intellectualism, however you want to frame that term?
Absolutely, absolutely. At least interest in it. Some of it's come from awful tragedies, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. The consciousness that's been, you know, distributed to the masses, courtesy of, you know, all manner of police brutality and improper, you know, pursuit of the law, whatever you want to call it, or whatever it's called. You know, I'm right now just giving it to you from my soul. Yeah, you see the brothers running around with dashikis. You see Nick Cannon. You know. I mean, like, but it's
Reverend
but it's
Doctor.
Real though. But it's real.
Reverend Doctor Nick Cannon. Now.
Hey man. Hey.
That's what he calls himself.
I like the search. You know what I mean? I like the journey. I like what's happening right now. You know, because you can talk to kids, you can hear them, you can see it on the internet, on your Facebook feed or whatever. So I just hope it leads to a longer thing. You know, trends, ebbs and flows in culture are, you know, continuous. I guess that's the only thing that doesn't change about culture and society is that it always changes and it ebbs and flows.
And I don't think it's new. I think that these conversations have been going on for decades in the Black community and in communities around the country. So I would argue that Black intellectualism, using critical thinking and analysis, has always been going on. We are now at a point where people are sort of rediscovering, and thank God they are, James Baldwin with I Am Your Negro. And I mean, I am not your Negro. See, I'm saying it. Look at me. I'm so whitewashed. I said, I am your Negro. That's what happens. I am your Negro, right?
But wasn't it Richard? With Baldwin during that time when Baldwin was talking? It didn't seem like the culture was more accepting of that.
It's the point that Carlo made here, where media was not as diverse as it is now, and it wasn't as accessible now. So in the 1950s, we just had one bookstore in our neighborhood, and we all went there and read the same book.
Right. Now we have five channels on television.
I'm sorry.
There's like five channels on television.
It was three, actually, because I was around during that time. It was three channels on TV.
Overshot then.
So we overshot. We were hopeful to get five channels. That fifth channel was really fuzzy.
Thank you guys so much for being part of the conversation. Carlo Campbell, Shamar Beasley, Gregory Walker, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us,
guys.
Our next conversation will feature Dr. Nyasha Jr., who teaches in the religion department at Temple University, and Andrea Lawful Sanders, who is the president and founder of A Lawful Truth Enterprises, and under that is the Divine Mother Diva Publishing imprint. Welcome to the show. All the conversations we've been having thus far, people have been pushing back on this idea of Black intellect and what that does that actually mean. So, Doctor, let's start with you. When you hear the term Black intellect, do you identify with that, and if not, why?
For myself, no. I don't identify as a Black intellectual, although I probably qualify. Mm-hmm. So I teach at Temple. I have a PhD. I'm bookish, nerdy, all those things that I think people tend to think about when you think about intellectuals. But for me, the term feels like it's suggesting intellectuals versus other people. So for me, I acknowledge what I do. So yes, I'm an educator, but I don't personally identify myself as a Black intellectual.
Andrea, do you consider yourself, I guess, a Black intellectual? Do you embrace that term? Do you reject it?
I consider myself a smart woman, period. So I am degreed, but I am not in academia. I don't have a doctorate, and yet I was able to still have a great conversation with Dr. Nyasha, and we handled each other sister to sister, right? Mm. I believe that if we treat each other well, period. Why do you want my mouth? I believe if we treat each other well, then it makes all the difference in the world. I grew up under Marcus Garvey and Tom Bogle and Nanny of the Maroons, and I learned that it's better to be smart, right, in the way, in a well-rounded way. So I never look down on anyone who doesn't have the academia like we did. Mm. I never look at anyone who's in the barbershop. There's some people who don't even know how to read a book, but are smarter than many of us.
We were talking about the barbershop.
Yes.
You it's know, a hub those of intellectualism. Conversations
because we must never take away the life experiences that people bring to the table. And when we do that and we separate ourselves as elitists, Black elites, then, you know, the people that are that never gone to formal schooling but are really smart, how do we learn from each other?
It was interesting that you say that. I wonder, can lived experience equal book knowledge, or does it surpass it in certain ways? When we think about expertise, if someone is an expert because of lived experience and someone's an expert because of what they read and what they've studied and what they researched, are they equal?
So I don't think so.
Okay.
So I'm well-read, well-researched, do a lot of work with schools and with police officers, as you already know. So But I always find that I am more impacted by someone who has had the experience,
okay.
right? Someone who has lived it, have been in it, and can give you direct contact. It's nice to read about it, and we do. We read and we learn from what we've read, and we learn from our research. But when you're out there in the streets and you're talking to people about how they're actually living, like I was telling you this morning, Chris, that the Lyft driver was talking to me about his marriage and all the things that had happened. And I had started having this great conversation with him about how black men feel valued by us women. In America.
I want to get to that in a second.
You know, yeah. And how we have had this conversation about we want this good, good man. But if he's doing all the wonderful things that we asked him to do, then he's considered soft. Just read a whole piece about it by a bunch of women who says, I'm single, I want a man, but you know, he's got to have a degree, he's got to be 6'4", he's got to have the flat stomach, all of that stuff. And they've not once touched on his core values mm-hmm. and the morals that he brings to the table. And when the man has that, and he comes with it, but he's not 6'4", and he doesn't have the washboard stomach, then it's, oh, he's soft, or he treats me well, and he opens the door for me, or he cooks for me. He's a soft. He's a punk. There's some sort of wimp, some simp, they call it. Mm. There's a definition in the dictionary called a simp, S-I-M-P, for a man who's considered too nice to his woman. Like, what do we want? You know, have we over-intellectualized everything in our lives? Mm. When do we get back to the basic stuff of just treating each other decently? That's just...
Do you want to answer that?
Did you want to answer the idea of whether people with lived experience are equal to those with book knowledge? If you don't, we can move on. But I just would love to know.
I think the difference is that they're valued differently.
Okay.
So I think that someone who has lived experience that is valuable, but is not always valued in the same ways as someone who has the resume or the CV. So I think there are different types of knowledge that may be valued differently and by different communities. Hmm.
So let's throw out the term black intellectualism for a minute and just say when we're speaking to two smart black women. Let's just go with that. So we had one of our earlier recordings, we had a conversation with a black activist, a female activist, who was talking about how she felt like it was her experience recently. She was getting a lot of questions from white friends of hers or white, you know, what we were talking about, white allies, more than, say, a black male in her life. And I guess I just wanted to throw that out to you, you know, in terms of being two, again, smart black women. Do you feel like, has that been your experience too, that you feel like you might get more questions from white people about race, about, you know, social justice compared to a black man?
I do, but it's my work. Mm-hmm. So I have had coffee chat conversations in my home. The very first one was in October of 2016 after watching all this vitriol flying in social media. And I got sick and tired of people just whining and complaining. So I put out an edict asking anybody who wants to have this conversation about race, I don't care what culture, wherever you come from, 50 people showed up at my house.
Wow.
50. White, gay, black, you name it. They were all, and they had taken over my living room floor. And what came out of that conversation was I had to start the conversation by saying, allow people to meet people where they are, right? Give them the space to have the conversation, because if they're here, then they're curious enough to want to have the dialogue. And I cannot tell you how much crying happened on that living room floor by white people who said they've always wanted to have the dialogue, but were so afraid of being pushed back and wanted to talk about their experiences as white children growing up, knowing that how black people were treated was wrong, but didn't have the space or the voice to have that conversation. Knowing that they wanted to have relationships and to bring friends home, but they kept hearing the N-word being thrown around in their house. But I got to tell you, what came out of that conversation was some of my white friends now having these conversations in their own homes, right? So 30, 40 people meeting in different cash. And they talk about it, but they're also now pushing back on their families. If they see something posted, let's take that crap down. Don't talk about people like that. What do you think that looks like? I'm a part of the family too, and I don't believe in what you're believing in. And I think that if we continue to have one-on-one conversations, real honest conversations about where we are and what that looks like, then more of these conversations will happen. Just writing about it, right, or talking about it on the radio or having a piece on television about it is not enough. We've got to get back to the basics because we have gotten to a place where we have, we're kind of desensitized, you know, to a lot of what's going on when Darren Mannon had his testicles squeezed. Remember that, Chris? Mm-hmm. And I was sitting in the courthouse with that mother. And he was sitting there just looking afraid. And everybody was fighting over who should do what. And Darren Mannon was just sitting there wondering what was going to happen to him next. And I don't think anybody really thought about the horror beyond the it was an atrocity that happened to him. But I don't think anyone really thought about the horror that he was dealing with, the nightmares that he was experiencing, what his mother was dealing with, the death threats that they were getting. And he didn't do anything other than run out the subway with his friends because it was cold and he didn't have on a jacket. They assumed he was doing something wrong, grabbed him, roughed him up, and squeezed his testicles. You know, those kinds of things are crazy to me.
Dr. Junior, why do you think it is that the woman Malcolm referred to, Leslie Mack, the co-creator of the Safety Box, and Andrea are having more white women or white people asking them about these issues? Is it that they perceive black smart women as less of a threat?
Or do you disagree with it? Because right. I didn't necessarily think that was the case, but that was her experience.
That hasn't been my experience, okay. But I would say that my guess would be that part of it is some white folks would view black women as less threatening, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and potentially as more open to having those conversations.
Does that translate into move into the capitalism angle of it? With the mainstream viewing black women as less threatening than black men, when the opportunities come for lectures and thought leadership, do you think that black women are given more opportunities than black men because of that appeal or no? Or do you think that it's reversed? I can see your face that you don't agree with that.
It's been my experience that if we are talking about black intellectuals or whatever term you want to use, by and large, people think of black men. Mm. So mm-hmm. people think about Cornel West, Michael Eric Dyson, Mark James Lamont Baldwin. Hill, mm-hmm. James Baldwin, and the like.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think those names come to the fore more quickly than black women. I think part of it has to do with just assuming that black leadership is male.
Mm.
Yes.
Mm.
And so even if we're talking civil rights era to now, there are, of course, many black women who are part of the leadership, part of the organizing. But when the cameras come, when the mic is there, there's a black man who's standing in front.
When you turn on cable news, when they're bringing in a black intellectual, it's more often than not Mark Lamont Hill or mm-hmm. Michael Eric Dyson or Cornel West. I can't even name a black intellectual woman that is a regular on cable news. And that's a problem, right? Or even local news.
Mm-hmm. Right. Melissa Harris Perry. Melissa Harris Perry.
Joy Ann Reed, but they're not contributors. They're anchors.
Right.
But I think, you know, even they are seeing kind of their media companies pushing them off, right? Joy Ann Reed was canceled. Her morning show was canceled for other people. Melissa Harris Perry was kind of pushed off. When we talk about black, smart black people, we've all got it. You know, you're one of the good ones, even if they don't say that, right? Yeah. I mean, is it that smart black people is the rule and the public thinks it's the exception, or is it vice versa?
I think that, again, we have different ways of knowing
mm-hmm.
and different ways of valuing that knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, what I have found, even with other black people, is I don't mention, again, where I teach, mm-hmm. and I don't mention that I have a PhD. I've had people who eventually found out
mm-hmm.
say, oh, you're actually cool. Because the assumption is if I'm someone with a PhD, then I'm basically a Whitley Gilbert.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've gotten that all the time. Yeah.
That the assumption is if you're at a certain level of
Whitley Gilbert for all of the people born in the 95s.
The children don't know. The millennials.
A different world.
Oh, my stars. Know your history, children.
Know your history.
Yes. But Whitley Gilbert, for me, is just a quintessential, clueless, bougie, stuck-up, unaware kind of person.
Yeah.
And so what I've had is people who told me after the fact, I assumed that all PhDs were like that.
Mm.
I assume that all of you were people who looked down on people like me. So for me, it's been a process of thinking how to not only for me to be comfortable in groups, but also how to make other people comfortable and how to make other people welcome. So, you know, you walk in the beauty shop, hey, everybody. I tell people, call me by my first name. I'm not somebody who mm-hmm. stands on ceremony and that mm-hmm. kind of thing. So some of it is about making people comfortable. And I think a lot of times people who don't have the same level of education have been made to feel less than.
I'm going to wrap up with this last question. Quick answers. We talked about representation, so, you know, briefly. And I wonder for those young girls, right, who don't get to see people like yourselves on TV all the time, and who see the kind of male dominated punditry class. What's your message to young black smart women who may grow up to either be like you guys or surpass you, but who don't necessarily see that representation and might not achieve to do that? Let's start with you, Anya. What would be your message?
So my message to them, to you, young women, because I'm assuming that you're listening, is that you don't have to see them on television. They're all around you. Find your mentors. Mm. Find the people that you want to emulate and want to learn from, as well as have them learn from you, and surround yourselves with them. Ask the hard questions, you know? Let them talk to you about their experiences. Learn from their experiences, and let them learn from you. They don't have to be on television. They really don't. And to always walk in your truth, mm-hmm. whatever that truth is. Because mm-hmm. your truth may not represent or look like someone else's truth, but all of us have a place in this world. Every last one of us. Our footsteps matter. Mm.
I would echo that. I would also say read. Mm. Reading is a way for you to travel to other places, to meet other people, to learn about other cultures. For me, I was a little black girl in Pensacola, Florida, and I did not see a lot of black women professionals in my life. Mm. But reading was a way for me to find other people and other ideas, and it can be something that you can hold on to until you get to the next step.
That was great. That was a really great conversation. Well, thank you both for coming on the program.
Really, Dr. Naisha Jr. on your Lawful Sanders. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
So now we're going to bring on Ernest Owens, and you can find a recent long-form article of his on gayborhood racism in the April issue of Philadelphia Magazines, which is currently on newsstands. Thanks for coming on, Ernest. One of the launching points for the topic was the movie I'm Not Your Negro. And I was wondering if, number one, if you've seen it. Have you seen it?
Yes, I saw it at the Ray for when it had its limited release.
Oh,
and it was really good. It was like a couple of weeks ago, but I saw it in February and I was excited about it.
So I've been reading some critiques of it. Largely everyone's loved it, but some people were criticizing the movie maybe for not bringing in Baldwin's sexuality into it, that it kind of glossed over it in the movie. And I was wondering if you had any reaction to that.
Well, yeah, I was looking forward to a holistic viewpoint of his life and a little bit more on his thoughts, because he was a very multidimensional, intersectional man. And I felt like it was interesting because the one time they brought up his sexual orientation, it was actually an FBI documented note, which almost made it seem like it was speculative, speculation yeah. rather than actual fact. And it was interesting that throughout the entire story, it centered around him admiring, acknowledging his life through the eyes of three cisgender black men, straight black men. Very and that, you know, even though I saw the connection between all four of the men, including Baldwin, I was really disappointed that from that dialogue, we couldn't see him individually. It was almost as though they used those three men as the focal point to appeal to a larger audience, almost as if Baldwin's story alone would have not been enough to bring people out to the theaters or keep them fully interested throughout the film. And that has happened in a lot of stories when we're talking about the civil rights era or just any movement. There always seems to be this dialing down of sexual orientation and the nuance of the black queer experience.
So we've been talking, I guess, about also the media piece to outlets for black intellectuals, or let's just say, you know, black writers or, you know, black thought leaders. And there's some duality, I think, with right now there's a moment where the public is really interested, I feel like, in black thought. At the same time, we've also been talking about, you know, there's not as much black-owned media, and there's also just less media, traditional media outlets. So you're someone who, you know, both locally and nationally has both been published and is a voice on, you know, a lot of traditional media. I guess I wanted to know, like, do you think this is a moment with a lot of opportunity, say, for black intellectuals in media, or more, I guess, like the inverse, that it's like less of a moment due to some of the forces just in the industry right now?
Well, it's both. But one thing I think that really frustrates me about conversations around black intellectualism is that a lot of times it becomes very monolithic and very elitist. The same people, and I mean, I can't, it's not earnest for me not to name the names, but it's just more like, you know, how many times do we have to go to an event and Mark Lamont Hill speaks? How many times do we, you know, exactly, how many times do we go to events and we get the same uberly college educated, you know, Eric Michael Dysons that speak, that are cisgender straight men that speak in a monolithic voice over the community? We don't see a lot of working class voices sharing their experiences and their lived trauma.
Back in the 60s, it was always James Baldwin, Sidney Poitier, Harry
Belafonte.
And that's highly problematic.
But
it's always been that way, right?
Well, we have seen deviations from that in like the Black Panther movement to some extent, where you start to see these other faces, you know, deviate from that, where they were like, listen, we're in the streets, we're in the community, and we're taking the mic and we're speaking out. In modern day time in this community in Philadelphia, I look at people like the Black and Brown Workers Collective, who is this intersectional queer group. They're young, they're in their 30s, their late 20s, and they're speaking about these issues from lived experiences. Their work in a nonprofit space, their work out here, you know, dealing with, you know, issues such as HIV and AIDS, dealing with poverty, dealing with trans issues, and they're talking about it from the grassroots and their insight. That's intellectual.
Do you have a responsibility? Do you feel like you have a responsibility as somebody who would maybe be perceived as a gatekeeper of a media institution to create a pipeline for those
Hell
types of people?
Yes.
Okay.
I absolutely, you know, am always finding a way to pass the mic or extend it or amplify voices in different ways. With the stories I tell, if I am going to talk about something, I try to include those voices in. If I'm not telling personal narratives of my own experiences, I try to find other people to do. And I spoke about that actually just on social media yesterday about this idea of opening up the space. Like, if we're going to be a collective of a community, we actually need to see various community voices. It's not just the same patriarchal structure of, you know, this... you know, Christian dominating male cisgender, you know, elder space. There is youth that needs to be included in this. There's working class that needs to be included in this. There's LGBT that needs to be included in this. There's spiritual, Muslim, non-religious that needs to also share a voice in this table when we're talking about intellectualism. Because, you know, when we're having conversations about white people and what they're doing on intellectual space, they have a spokesperson for almost every issue. Mm-hmm. They got an Asian. They got Dan Savage for LGBT. They have Ellen. They have, you know, Noam Chomsky. They have all these different types of thought leaders. We don't have that in our community.
You don't think so?
I don't think they're getting elevated. Mm. I know they exist, but I'm not seeing them on CNN. I'm seeing the same people on CNN. I'm seeing the same people come into these college and universities talking, and it's almost
is that because a redundancy. All leaders, and we talk about spaces, you think black intellectuals themselves overall have a responsibility to engage movements?
Yes, I mean, for one, let me get them together. Your presence is not charity. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people that think that because they've acquired this level of prestige, that automatically puts them in position where, because of their past experience and knowings, that divorces them of responsibility. It doesn't. The responsibility continues with and without the degrees, with or without the talk show spots, with or without the book deals. We have a moral and social responsibility to go back. And I think that that's how you continue to foster and cultivate intellectualism for all different class groups and racial identities, and also within our own black community, the community at large. Because this is not the current face of black intellectualism is not accurate. Mm. It's not accurate.
We'll have to leave it on that.
Yeah. Oh my God. There's so many questions. I want to keep going, but Ernest, we'll definitely have you on again, I'm sure, awesome, in the future. Thank you so much always for your insight.
Always a pleasure, sir.
Thank you.
Well, that was a good conversation. Wouldn't you say that, Flynn?
It was a lot. I learned a lot. I didn't realize people push back that much on the title Black Intellect.
But, we should put it in quotations next time.
Man. Yeah, but I think that's the biggest thing that I learned. What about you?
I would probably concur with that. Yeah, I don't say I'm still not exactly sure now. I guess I'm probably more confused than when I started about what the term actually means. But I think it was an interesting diversity of opinion. So
You
know, make sure to tweet at us if you have thoughts about, you know, the conversation that we had and also what Black intellectualism is.
I'm Flood the Drummer on Twitter, FLOODTHEDRUMMER.
I am unoriginally at Malcolm Burnley on Twitter. I'm particularly excited about our next episode, and we encourage everyone to subscribe to Pushback on iTunes, and as well as make sure to follow at Philly Mag and at 900 AM WURD on Twitter.
And we can't forget, if you aren't an Apple iPhone user, don't have iTunes, bookmark phillymag.com/podcast or subscribe to 900mwurd.com where you can get the SoundCloud link. And for Malcolm Burley and I, until next time, I'm Flood the Drummer, and I'm drumming for justice.